You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
This is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Hayward, and with me are Greg Balderston from Forest Glade, Ben Brooker from Treasure Perennials, and Meryl Johnson from Seedscape. And we've just been saying, wow, it's been a real summer this year, and we haven't had one for a few years.
No, we've had three tender years, beautiful years. If only it could always be like that, but it can't. This is Australia. We've got to have the hot summer. And it's good for the environment in a way, but not quite so hot, please. But anyway, as I was just saying, I've got all my old sheets out, old net curtains, anything to throw over the things that are really going to suffer in the direct rays of the sun. Things in the shade usually cope pretty well because although the ambient temperature is hot, if there's plenty of mulch around, there's enough humidity in the air to keep things okay. But where they're getting direct scorching westerly sun, you might need to protect some things, even if it's a really dry, hardy, normally robust, resilient plant.
And as you say, it's a change as well. It's got to go from, you know, a even humid warm to dry hot.
Exactly.
If the plants aren't used to it, they can sulk for a few days until they start closing up all their little holes and stop losing moisture to the atmosphere.
Yeah, they don't look very happy. They always, you can see them starting to wilt and sulk. So.
And we haven't had those days and days of heavy north winds, and I think it's the north wind that...
We had some easterlies, though.
Oh, I love an easterly.
Yeah, so we had quite a few easterlies there, and it's sort of... Because the plants aren't used to it, we can sort of have a lot of branches drop.
Mm.
So a lot of big branches.
Yeah, pressure from the opposite direction.
Yeah, and they're not used to it.
Yeah. So.
It's all about being not used to it, isn't it?
Yeah.
If they build up to things, they can cope really much better and built to cope in many cases.
It describes evolution, I guess, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes, well, with me, I was looking at my Judas tree. I had... Sylvie had her environmental group up and we were walking around the garden and I said, this is a Judas tree. It was totally extraordinary. Half of them had no idea who Judas was. I said, this is a Judas tree, so obviously it's from Palestine. And they all just looked, well, not all, but most of them looked at me completely blankly. The Irish girl, she knew.
Yes, good Catholic girl. She'd know about Judas.
She knew who Judas Iscariot was. But, I said to them, this tree... because it was really hot as we were walking around. This tree, it's going to survive. It survived right through the drought. It didn't mind the drought.
Yeah.
But some of these other trees here will not be as happy.
Mm. But I love Judas trees. We've got one in our garden too. And it's called the Judas tree, well, for many reasons, but possibly the most likely reason is the flower buds come straight out of the bark. There's no stem. They just erupt out of the bark and they're like droplets of blood when they're quite deep rosy pink.
Mm.
And it's believed that there was a resemblance noticed between the droplets of blood on the Christ figure, you know, on the way to the cross with the crown of thorns on, and that's why it was called the Judas tree, because of the weeping droplets of blood, yes. Mm.
And it is unusual in that the flowers pop straight out of the
bark.
Mm. The bark.
And it can actually flower all over the whole tree if it really wants to, if it's having a very good year, even on the trunk, which is extraordinary.
Mm. Mm. No, they're quite pretty.
Very pretty foliage.
And in the pea family, too,
yes.
I think.
Yes, yeah. So nitrogen fixing and and well adapted, given their native habitat of the Middle East, they are well adapted to really dry summers. So excellent. And not too big. It's a good domestic tree.
Yes. Yep.
A nice shape, nice shady shape.
Yes, and I think it was my best during the drought. So what other trees have been drought hardy for you? Of course, the oaks seem to be once they're up and big, don't they?
Yeah, oaks are pretty good. It's a shame that I might get looks of disapproval, but it's a shame many years ago that a lot of elms were planted. I don't think elms cope well with
the hot, dry summers. They're pretty surface rooting, aren't they?
And they're not that good a tree either. They're pretty shabby autumn colour, and they, especially now, they're full of elm beetle and a few other different diseases. And
we have the last great stand in the world.
Yeah, so it's a shame. Yeah, but it's also a shame that all those years ago there were so many planted. I've got elms along the main road out the front of my property, and between being completely massacred every few years by the power line companies.
Yes.
And the diseases and the hot droughts that we have, they're just not. And if they were oak trees, even the pruning, the oak trees seem to handle a lot better than the elms do. But yeah, the oaks can handle, especially some of the ones that come from the drier climates as well.
And,
We've got a big oak on our property and I absolutely love it. Yeah. Like on a day like this, it'll be like 10 degrees cooler.
It is 10 degrees cooler, isn't it, under your oak?
There's so many different varieties of it too that all look, you know, all do something nice, whether it's different acorns or, you know, huge leaves or little leaves or evergreen.
Or golden oaks. I mean, if you meet a big golden oak, that's a sight to behold.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I quite like those frosted elms, you know, the elms that have got a little
frosted
white around the edge. I think they're rather beautiful.
Yeah,
yeah, they are. Yeah, I've got only a little one, which I'm trying to work out where to plant it. So
and I think they're Asian species, so the frosted elms and things, like the smaller leafed elms, I think.
Because I've got a number of the Chinese elm in my garden and they seem to cope quite well.
Mm. Yeah, it's just, as I say, it's something. And it still happens today where whether it's because it's easy to propagate or whatever the reason is, all of a sudden these things, whatever they are planted everywhere, whether they're capital pears or whatever it is that's in the trend and it's being planted as street trees or, you know, overplanted everywhere. And then instead of having this beautiful tree, you know, 150 years' time, you've got this thing that's diseased and might lose a big branch or fall over, or it's getting constantly cut off or misshapen or, you know, infested with something. So,
and planting around your house, you know, it's sort of important. Well, not for the city so much, although in some places it is, when you look at what's happened in California, to plant trees that actually are not going to burn and explode.
Yes.
You know, like pines are notorious, and I've got pines all over my place and I can't take them down because the black cockatoos now are completely dependent on them.
Well, deciduous trees are really good because they don't really sort of produce a lot of those oils like a lot of the...
Yes,
like
who's ever heard of oak oil?
Well, that's it. So they do say to try and use exotic trees that if you do have a barrier, if you've got a forest or a bushland near you, if you have that sort of barrier with like deciduous trees or sort of forest, sort of rainforest trees, like to give you that nice sort of lot of moisture in the leaf.
That's it. And they're very leafy at the time of the year when bushfires are likely.
They still burn, but it's a cold burn. So they don't just go up in within minutes.
And it's the oil. They don't explode.
Yeah. Mm. So, and that's what they're saying too. If you can take away a lot of those sort of native sort of plants that do produce a lot of these oils away from the house and then plant that barrier, you've got a better chance.
And they're also, because they're very leafy in full summer foliage, they're going to help catch some embers. Yeah. I mean, in the face of a raging inferno like they had in California and we get in our forest areas, it's just run like hell.
You can't stop it, yeah. But it does, instead of being that really extreme heat, tends to be a bit more of a colder burn.
Exactly.
So it just gives you that extra,
little barrier.
Yeah, that barrier.
But talking about temperature control, we were commenting before about how, you know, a lovely spreading tree can just completely alter the temperature.
And, you know, we've got a lot of trees and plants. It's a very foliagey, leafy garden. And yet 10 degrees is not a big ask. 10 degrees cooler on a hot day is not a big ask for our garden, because it is just so leafy. And
if you plant on your western side, if you plant trees on your west and on your northern side, deciduous trees, but trees on your western side, so that tonight, when that sun is still blazing at 7 o'clock, because the air is so hot.
It always
hot.
Seems it's hottest sort of between 5 and 7, I reckon, the sun.
Yeah.
This time of year. Yeah.
And the other thing they say is if you put a little sort of a little water feature along the edge of your house, and so you, so any wind coming into your house goes across water, and that just cools it down. Yeah. Well, you were saying, Greg, that you actually...
Yeah, last night it was a bit hot, and I don't have air conditioner, or I don't really use fans that much, but I needed to water the garden bed out my bedroom window, so I just put a small sprinkler on my big canvas blinds, and after about an hour or so, a cool draft started coming in, and, yeah, cooled the room down quite substantially over a few hours, yeah.
Yes, well, that's... that. I mean, water does that, because I've noticed at Point Lonsdale it'll be boiling hot in the front. I've got a family house down there, and the front of the house will be quite cool and the back of the house will be totally hideous, and the front of the house just gets the water, gets the breeze off the water.
Yes. Of an afternoon, I think, even with your garden, because your plants will, because we get such high temperatures, plants will stop photosynthesising. They stop, you know, doing the gas exchanges and everything. So they're going to automatically start to wilt. So from the extreme heat, no matter what you do with water.
Yeah.
But if you give it a light sort of sprinkle in the afternoon, that actually is just enough to cool it down. The plant can sort of take up that bit of moisture just of an afternoon. But you want to do it when there's shadows there. If you can actually have it where there's shadow, then start throwing a bit of water around, and that sort of protects your plants a lot too. So
and it does
gets
drop,
ready for the next day.
Exactly, and it does drop that temperature inside the plant, the air around the plant, just for a little while to give it a chance to catch its breath.
Yeah, because I think we forecast, I think at least for the next 2 weeks, we are expecting sort of, you know, high temperatures.
Oh.
So I think
And, of course, up north they're getting so much rain, they're having terrible floods.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think instead of sort of wasting our water and sort of really sort of soaking in and it evaporating, I think if you just do that light sort of sprinkle, that's just sometimes just enough to get your plants through, so which you want to try and do.
Yeah, watering's a good one, because it depends what you're watering too sometimes on how you water them. Like like hydrangeas do best if you're watering them a little bit every day in this sort of weather. But things like trees with deeper roots, things with deeper root systems, you're better off letting them even stress a little bit and then give them a really good soak. And some years you might only have to water them once or twice, or on a year like this it might be a little bit more. But things with deeper roots, if you give them a longer soaking water.
Less frequently.
But you're right, though, because that's hardening the plant off.
Yeah. Even the smaller and the roots plants, follow the water down into the ground, so they're not up near the surface. And as you say, things like perennials and annuals and things like that obviously got very shallow root systems and hydrangeas. So a more regular water, a lighter regular water is what those things need.
But you're right about the stress. So I think the plant needs that stress to sort of, to sort of acclimatise as well. So
that's why often, especially from the big nurseries and Bunnings and places, if you buy something that's been stuck in a in a greenhouse its whole life and getting perfect watering, and you get it home, it's not hard. You stick it out in the ground, and it'll often have a tough time. Yeah,
a sudden collapse.
Yeah, you say that because we did go to we went to a show a few years ago, and these probably like 1.5 meter foxgloves, perfect foxgloves, and you could straight away you could tell it was straight out of a hot house, and it's like liquid fertilised probably every day.
Yeah.
Water every probably 5 minutes sort of
perfect
thing.
Conditions.
So you can see that whoever bought it would have taken it home, planted it, and expected this beautiful plant to stay like that, but it just would
They've
have
seen
just,
it at its peak already.
Yeah. It just would have burnt and probably just died straight away.
This is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Haywood, and with me are Greg Balderston, Ben Brooker and Merrill Johnson. I thought we might just mention what's on for the next couple of months.
It's a busy time,
isn't
it?
It's a very busy time.
Exciting.
So I think it is. If you grab your pens, in about 2 minutes I will tell you what's coming up. But I think it's worth writing it down because it is an interesting time coming up. We've got so many fairs, and you've just had one, haven't you, Ben?
Well, we had, Open Garden. So that was through Creative Harvest. So that's a not-for-profit organisation. They started in 2017. So that's run by the Borbor Sustainability Network. So there's 12 gardens that's actually was involved this year. So, and they all had different sort of perspectives with their garden, mostly all about with food and just how they live more sustainable. So with their orchards and solar panels, all that sort of stuff, how to live, sort of pretty well more off the grid sort of thing. So it was like the 12 gardens, they give up their own time. So it's basically they're sort of donating their properties and their time for the weekend. So it's a big effort for everyone who was actually involved with Creative Harvest. And there's all certain activities as well. So they had there's certain different talks on like beekeeping, or there would have been on preserving fruit.
And they do this every year, don't they?
Yeah, every year.
It's regular now, yes, which is great.
Yeah, so I find it's a bit hard time of the year in summer because the garden's sort of not looking.
I won't let people come to my garden in February.
But the veggie garden looked perfect. It looked really good. So so I did a talk on basically regenerative sort of practices in our soils. So how to sort of create your own sort of living fertilisers and, particular sort of mulches and on what they specifically do and a lot to do with the bacteria and our fungi biome and their role. So how important it is for our garden. Yeah.
And we had a friend just down the road who opened her garden for Creative Harvest, and it was a masterclass on how to grow vegetables from seed and how to lay out a vegetable garden to give constant food production, but not too much. Yeah. Do you know how often the problem, and I'm guilty of it,
zucchinis.
I get gluts. No, I've even burnt all the zucchini recipes. I'm sick of them. But no, she's a lady who lives alone, does the garden herself, and I have to say it just looked absolutely stunning. Hats off to Patsy, one of the best vegetable gardens I've ever seen. But it was a masterclass on how to use vegetable seed to just grow enough and get that continuity of production. So lots of little tiny sections along big, long raised beds so that she could go out and pick something. We went to her place for lunch the other day and everything in the salad had come out of the garden, and God, it tastes delicious.
Yeah, it always
so
tastes
fresh.
Better.
Yeah. Tastes so much better.
But it is so crucial not to plant everything at the same time.
Yeah, get the succession sowing happening. Just a little row and then a couple of weeks later, another little row. Terribly hard when you've got a great big packet of carrot seed not to sow the whole lot.
Absolutely. And, of course, with things like coriander, because it'll bolt at this time of year, so you want to keep and just collect the seed and replant it. The only difference for me is in summer I plant my coriander in the shade.
Yes.
And in winter I plant it in the sun.
Yes. Mm. Yep.
Because of the bolting.
Yes.
I just snip the flowers when it starts to bud. I snip it off, and then often you'll get those lateral shoots which will still have the foliage. It'll still bolt.
I also get that little bit, a couple of extra weeks
out of a plant. Yeah.
I also love the green seed to eat. Green seed is so delicious.
Isn't it?
Sprinkle it on top of a curry or sprinkle it into a salad. Except that, of course, some people just loathe coriander.
I know. It's one of those things you either love or hate.
I adore it.
I do.
It's a genetic change in people's genes where some people can eat coriander and some can't. It's actually a
genetic.
They've actually found the gene that makes you like coriander or not. Yeah.
Isn't that extraordinary? This is the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Hayward, and with me is Greg Balderston, Ben Brooker and Merrill Johnson. Now, I hope you all got your pens out because I am now going to give you a few things to write down and to remember. Next week at Ferny Creek in their general meeting, John Arnott is going to talk to us Well, I won't make it, unfortunately. I've got... It is Emma, our presenter, Emma's baby's first birthday.
Oh.
John speaking to Fernie Creek, and I'm taking a walk in the Botanic Gardens. So I can't go
to both.
To Dottie's. I can't go to Dottie's birthday, and I can't go and hear John. So John Arnott, who is also one of our presenters, is a former manager of horticulture at RBG Cranbourne. He was also at Geelong Gardens, and he was also at the zoo. And he's going to talk about a journey through great gardens, reflecting over 40 years of public garden horticulture. So I think that will be really interesting. And there's always door prizes and a raffle. And, I mean, it's a good thing to do, Fernie Creek. It's fun. So next week, February the 8th, John will be speaking at the Fernie Creek General Meeting. And then on March the 8th and 9th, Fernie Creek will be having its Plant Collectors Expo, which is one of those great things where people who are not Bunnings and who are not really big nurseries sell their stuff. And I presume you will be there?
Sadly, I won't be for the first time since it started, but we have a family event that weekend, so.
But Ben, you will be there?
Yeah, we're preparing for that now, so, yeah, trying to get as much as we can sort of ready for that. So hopefully we should have a good substantial range.
It's wonderful because the people that grow the unusual plants are at that plant fair, that Plant Collectors Expo.
Yes.
So that's March the 8th and 9th. And then, of course, the last week of March is MIFCAS, Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show. And so that runs from the Wednesday to the Sunday. And then in April, on the 6th, we've got the Gippsland Plant Fair, which also has...
which is in Broughton Hall. So that's in Gindevic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only a one-day event, so that's only just on the Saturday only.
Yes. And that's the same as what you're saying about Fernie Creek too. You get some really good growers there.
Yes.
You do. And then you have access to his garden, so you walk around his garden.
Which is great.
Stunning garden. It's a great day out because it's a very big garden, fabulous views, lovely countryside, lots of other things to see and do. But I don't think many people actually get out of the plant fair for most of the day.
No, because it starts off into the birch, like you go through his nursery and then you start off into the birch forest. And then it sort of goes back towards the house. So it's actually a really nice layout.
It is.
So it's a gentle sort of even sort of walk.
And it is an absolutely stunning view.
Yes. It is,
It is a really beautiful place to be.
Yes.
But it is a range of exhibitors too, as Ben was saying. We'll certainly be there. We've got that one nailed. And just being a one-day event, it seems to be really fun because everybody flocks in. Everyone's excited and comparing notes about plants.
Yeah, there's no slow day.
No slow time. It's just full-on plant fun.
Mm. Yeah. And I think I'm doing a talk there as well, so, on that day.
And then the following week, April the 13th, or 12th and 13th, is it, or 13th and 14th, the Upper Yarra Valley Garden the Upper Yarra Valley Plant Fair will be happening in Wandon, and that's a two-day event and is absolutely wonderful, and we will be doing a live broadcast from there, and we hope. And also Carbloom starts then, which is Tessellar's festival, which runs for a week. So there's lots to do over those 2 months.
Yes. And the Yarra Valley Plant Fair as well. So they have that plant auction.
Yes.
So there's quite a few different sort of activities at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair. And I think also John Arnott's actually going to be a guest speaker there as well.
Yes.
So, and it's actually quite good how they got it laid out because they do actually have the Seasol stage, which they have a lot of sort of big speakers, but they also have something that's a bit more intimate where it's all just everyone's sort of sitting down and
like a plant, clinic.
Like a discussion sort of thing which is sort of quite good as
well.
That's
fun as well. It's a real family day, I feel. The gardener can bring the non-gardening partner and the kids and even the dog.
That's true,
And it's just a lovely family day for gardeners to enjoy. But on the other hand, we have a lot of clients who come to us at that fair and they've deliberately left the husband and the kids at home because they just want to have full-on plant fun.
Spend time to do what they
absolutely.
Want to do.
Yes. And that's the sort of fair that it is. All the growers, like Ben, like myself, we're all there
to talk to people and, you know, help them with their problems or suggest ideas or just basically rave about plants and how much we enjoy something or the things that have given us trouble over the years. So it's a great, great talking day as well. I'm always hoarse by the end of it.
Yeah. And I think Peter Harris as well from White House Eats should actually probably have his begonias there.
Yes.
He always does it. He always does a big display of either it was the Pacific Coast irises or it'll be spring. The begonias.
And when Pete gets into something, he really gets into something.
Well, yes. Yeah. And he does a fantastic job with his displays too.
Yes. So, beautiful.
Yeah.
And he will be opening at White House, won't he, soon for his begonias?
He should be, yeah. Also, because Pete usually lets us borrow some of his begonias at Forest Glade to fill up the conservatory for a few months, which should be up there, you know, in the next sort of 4 weeks or so.
And the irises too, doesn't he?
He did for one year, but I think he's there was a show or something he wanted to take them to, so we haven't sort of used them since. But yeah, he's usually, once the begonias are up and running at his place out in Ashbourne, they're open pretty much every weekend, I think.
I think it's every weekend.
But check out the website at White House Nursery or their Facebook page or Instagram. Yeah, when Pete gets into something, he dives real deep into it.
He's got the knowledge too. So that's the beauty, I think, about these fairs too, because you've got specific growers which are sort of specialised in different fields and their knowledge is just you can't find it anywhere
and they're
else.
Generous with it too.
They are. And that's what it should be about sharing. And that's what I mean, like you hear some people and they probably have this idea and they will hold that idea really close to them and until they pass away and then that idea has become of anything. And I just don't understand why we just can't share.
Well, of course, that's the whole point of Plant Trust.
Yes.
You know, Plant Trust was set up to make sure that plants were shared around so that if somebody had a really rare plant and something happened, they died, it died, it disappeared, they got burnt out in a fire. It was somewhere else.
Yes.
The whole point is to share.
Yeah.
And particularly in Australia, because a lot of the plants we've got in from overseas will never be getting in again.
That's right.
Mm. I mean, we'll never get blackberry in again. Is this a sad thing? Maybe not.
And they are delicious, though.
On a slightly smaller scale, we've got a flower show up at the Hort Hall in March as well. I think it's March 15th and 16th, although the best day for public viewings on the 16th. And it's small and it's a community thing.
That's Mount Macedon.
The Mount Macedon Horticulture Society's Autumn Flower Show. The best day to come and look at the show's on March the 16th, the Sunday. Just one of those. We've gone
another fun thing.
It's sort of a rough thing because you can either go down the thing of having lots of official judges and dahlia medallions and rose medallions, and everything's very serious, which doesn't always work out well. I don't think it's a bit too serious for a lot of the local gardeners, and so we went the other direction the last sort of 10-15 years. And it's trying to involve the community and, get lots of homegrown veggies, and there's kids sections, and the novelty from anything that grows that the children do is always full of surprises and wonders and treats. And it's also my 30th year as show manager. So I started when I was 17. It's my 30th year as the show manager, which is that's a long time now.
Surely not. You started when you were five.
Well, I started showing when I was six, I think, or six or seven, maybe eight. I've been to every show since 1986, I think.
Fabulous.
And been the show manager since the early 90s.
That is absolutely brilliant.
So it's not huge. Nice little community event. If you're up in Mount Macedon on the Sunday, the March 16th, then you can drop into the Horticultural Hall and have a look.
It's a bit early for the colour up at Mount Macedon, isn't it, for the autumn foliage colour?
Oh, for the autumn foliage it definitely is, yes. But it's a really good, because we usually have it on the same weekend. Sometimes it's varied over the years. Occasionally we've had to change the date, but like we certainly get good runs where it's basically the same weekend for 4 or 5 years or sometimes even 10 or 15 years. And it's interesting to see how the seasons affect the flowering times of plants, because some years, you know, we'll have 30 entries in the belladonna section and then the next year we won't have any.
None.
Yeah. And the same with nerines or gladys. The one thing we do have a pretty good entry rate every year are the hydrangeas. They just vary in quality sometimes. Sometimes they're a bit burnt in the hotter years. But
they usually have an incredibly long flowering period, don't they? I love the colour transitions in
the autumn colours are often much better than the
Once the nights start to cool down, the colours of the flowers can be extraordinary.
Yeah. And if you're choosing hydrangeas, I'd keep that in mind too. There's some a lot of the newer varieties that you see, especially the bicoloured ones, are obviously bred to be showy when they're in what you would call full bloom or summer colour. But some of the best hydies, like there's some really old-fashioned ones up around Mount Macedon that have been there, you know, since the 1870s, and they're not much to look at when they're flowering, but once they start going autumn colours, they get like still blue and green and all these amazing colours, yeah.
Some of ours are doing that. They, at the moment, I think because of the stress of the weather, they've started doing it early, but they're almost opalescent in their colour. So we have vivid, you know, peacock blue hydrangeas, but they've got all these bronze and green and purple opalescent bloom on the flowers, which I think is really more lovely than the solid peacock blue.
I think
blue.
So too, And a lot of the species ones too, certainly from Japan and Asia, the smaller lace cap ones, they're not quite as impressive as the big mop tops because the flowers are only quite small in comparison. There's one called one of the hydrangea serratas, and when it's in fresh bloom, the florets are white with the blue or pink centre, depending on your soil. But as they go into autumn colour, the white starts getting splotched with scarlet. And by the end of the season, if they've done well, the whole floret is this velvety scarlet red. Yes. And they sort of turn their little petals upside down. You've got these beautiful scarlet red florets around it.
Quite spectacular.
Spectacular. Really. Some of the autumn colours on Heidi's, it's their best phase, I think.
I love the hydrangea paniculata grandiflora that don't have mop tops or even lace caps. They have a big, long, cone-shaped flower. For a start, they're very graceful shrubs with their arching habit and the flowers sort of arching right over, so it displays the cones really well. But I do love the colour transitions. And ours are starting early this year, again, because of the weather stress. So they're white to begin with. Well, sorry, go back a bit. When they start to open, they're green.
Yeah.
Then they go pure white. And then as the nights start to cool or they start to stress, the flowers go pink flushes and end up vivid pink by the end of autumn.
They're a bit hardier with the water too.
They
the
are much harder
because they're one of the American species.
Yeah,
And same with the quercifolia.
The oak leaf
quercifolia snowflake is still probably my favourite hydrangea after all these years.
Yes. I find the quercifolia gets very attacked by the rabbits. The others don't.
The wallabies. I'd propagated about 30 of them for Forest Glade, and I thought I'm going to put a nice big bank of snowflake quercifolia up the drive in front of the house and have it spilling over the blue stone wall. And the wallaby decided that he liked it or she liked it. And I had to carefully fertilise it every week or so with a little handful of blood and bone. So I just walk up and down them once a week.
Oh, just scattering
sprinkle,
the blood.
Sprinkle, not much, just enough to make a smell.
So what do you sprinkle on them?
Blood and bone.
Blood and bone.
Yeah. And the smell sort of puts a rabbit, it'd work with rabbits too, I think. But yeah, the smell of, you know, cooked flesh and bone sort of puts the herbivores off a little bit. But as soon as the smell's gone, they'll get back into it. So
you've got to be regular.
You've got to be just a little bit, but, yeah, regular, especially after rains and whatnot.
What I've found, I've never had this before, I've, of course, got roots going through my paths because my paths are sawdust, and the rabbits have been scratching the sawdust back and just eating the top of the roots.
Turning into wombats.
I've never seen it before. Yeah, it can't be. I mean, there is a wombat down the very back, but that's, you know, three paddocks away.
Well, they'd do a little bit more damage than that.
Yes, exactly. No, it's the rabbits. They're just appalling this year.
They're probably starting to get a bit hungry.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about this the other day too, we've had three good years, as we said.
And the little varmints have bred up too.
And you get that population expansion in the good years, and then all of a sudden things start getting a bit tough. And like I've noticed this year, things that the rats and possums usually eat, you know, in March, they've already
into it.
They're gone. So crab apples and I've got a Viburnum opulus knot cuts, which has amazing berries in autumn, but in the last couple of years I've got the seeds to autumn, and I don't think any of the birds really ate them, but the rats like the seeds inside, not the flesh, but the seeds.
They'll climb
right out to the ends of the branches where the berries hang. And they don't eat the berry, they chew a hole in the side and eat the seed out of the middle. And then you just come out and you find all these beautiful yellow and red berries all over the ground just before they turn into, you know, red glass beads when they look their best. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, crab apples and there's a nashi pear which only really possums eat. It's the one tree where the possums like them after I like them. So I get the pick, and then the possums eat the leftovers off this nashi pear.
They're already gone.
They were eaten a month ago.
I had about 50 musk lorikeets in my nashi pear, and musk lorikeets are quite rare. You know, they're not one of the really common ones. I must have had 50 of them.
Yeah.
They stripped the tree in 2 days, and it's a big tree.
Yeah.
And they just stripped it.
Mm-hmm. So if you do notice things like that, differences in your garden this year, that's probably the reason, is there's been a population expansion in the last few years, and it's not sustainable in a year like this, so a lot of those animals are doing it really tough.
Well, we've got black rabbits, and when I gillarooed out in Western Australia, the old geezer on the property said you get one black rabbit for every 1,000 ordinary, and I've seen black rabbits several times, which makes me very unhappy. Because I can't poison. Nervous.
No.
We've got eagles, we've got, I mean, exactly. I can't, no, can't. We can't poison.
Yeah. No.
Not to mention the dogs and the cats.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I mean the domestic cats, you know.
Mm.
I can't poison my neighbour's cats, but I also absolutely don't want to poison the eagles, so I can't poison them. No. So it's a real problem. This is the 3CR Garden Show. With me today is Greg Balderston, Ben Brooker and Merrill Johnson. Our talkback line is 94190155. If you'd like to give us a ring, have a chat to us about anything you fancy, or if you want to send us an SMS, but no photos on your SMS, 0488 809 855. Because it comes through the computer, we can't take any photos. Now, if you're interested in going to the Fernie Creek Plant Collectors Expo on March the 8th and 9th, we have got one free double pass to give away today. So if you ring in on 94190155 and leave your name with Doug or Matt, one of our producers, we will give you a free pass to the Fernie Creek Plant Collectors Expo. So that's really nice of the expo, of Fernie Creek, to give us some, because it's a great day.
Oh, it is. And it's a lovely setting just to be able to wander around their horticultural gardens as well.
Yes, because that's the other thing. It's another beautiful big garden.
It is.
With and lots of interesting plants.
Huge old trees. So if it's a warm weekend, it's a great spot to be.
Because it's not too hot.
Because it's not too hot. Yes. Well, you've got the elevation too of the mountainside there.
Well, that's something that really shocked me with you, Greg, that you're actually higher than I am.
Yeah, so the base of Mount Macedon's about the same height as the top of Mount Dandenong.
There you go. Yeah,
when I've been to your place, I've just thought of it as flat.
It is on the Great Divide, though. Like it's we're part of the Great Dividing Range. Yeah, so but where I am is about 500 metres above sea level, just over that.
Which is actually quite high.
The top of Mount Dandenong's about 80 metres higher. I think it's just under 600. And the top of Mount Macedon's just over 1,000. So it's
considerably
still just on the edge. It's not. It'll in a few decades, or at least a few hundred years, it won't be anymore. But it's a last little island of alpine remnants still left. So you've got snow gums and you know, 10, 12,000 years ago, it would have been like being at the top of Mount Buffalo or Mount Hotham or somewhere like that. And the few remnants of the last ice age are just hanging on to the top of Camel's Hump and the snow gums and a few other bits and pieces hanging
interesting,
on.
Interesting.
But yeah, it's surprising how high it is. It's often interesting looking at elevation because it can mean different things in different areas too. Like, you know, in southwestern Tasmania, 600 metres is
snow line.
is well above the snow line where, you know, at Mount Macedon it's at right up the top, pretty much that sort of snow line, the same snow line.
I've had snow at my place twice, but it's never sat on the ground. It's sat there for, you know, half an hour.
Every 5 or 10 years in Romsey we'll get a good dusting. I remember about 20-something years ago I was visiting a friend and I couldn't get home because it snowed. It was about like a foot of snow in Romsey, yeah. And all the roads were white I couldn't get home. And it used to snow at Mount Macedon at least a couple of times every year, which is not as much anymore.
No, likewise, we used to get snow regularly. Yeah. You know, you could count on getting it once or twice in a winter, but a lot of winters miss now, which is a fair indication of what's happening.
Mm.
And, of course, this is why the Mount Dandenong Botanic Gardens is actually taking things from out of above, well above Cairns and places like that and planting them there because they can survive here and they've got no higher to go.
And again, that's a good indication for elevation too. If you look in tropical areas, at high altitude things from tropical areas, they survive here quite well as long as they get a little bit of water in summer.
Yes.
It's a very similar climate, except they don't have the cold, wet winters. They have slightly wetter summers.
Mm.
So you look at plants from high altitude Mexico, in places like the Dandenongs and Mount Macedon, those plants do quite well as long as they get a little bit of water in the heat of summer and they're not in boggy ground in winter. So that altitude where you are makes a difference to how high you are or how low you are to sea level. If you look around the world, you can often find a spot that's completely different climate to what we have here, but for a freak of geology and whatever, you can find something that can grow in your garden here quite well, even though the habitat that it came from's almost completely different. Yeah.
Interesting.
We've just had a text from Fermi to say on February the 22nd, the Alpine group is having their buy, swap and sell at Alinda Community House. That's always fun. So if you have anything, take it. You can swap. People will be selling. So that's February the 22nd. The Alpine Garden Group of having their buy, swap and sell. Sorry, Fermi, I don't know why I didn't manage to have that on my list. And I will put this list onto our socials because there's so much on, it's difficult to remember it all. Somebody else has asked, could we tell them what flowers ladybirds particularly like?
Ah, okay.
I would have said it's flowers that are suffering from whitefly.
Yes.
Yeah, well, it's aphids. So they tend to go for the aphids a lot. So, yeah, it's not really a particular flower tend to go for. It's more they're actually, they'll eat the...
They'd probably like willows then because willows seem to have a huge affinity with aphids at this time of year. And I noticed both bees and European wasps hang around willow trees and I always wondered what they were doing. And then I realised that the willows are covered in aphids up the stems and the wasps and bees like the nectar from the aphids. So you've got this little weird ecosystem. So maybe the ladybirds might like,
I've noticed ladybirds on just about anything the garden at the moment.
Well, I'm just waiting because my vegetable garden's just had a bit of an attack, an aphid attack. And I was saying to my daughter, no, Sylvie, we can't. She wanted to garlic spray it. I said, you can do it once, but that's all. Because if you spray with something, obviously not poisons, but if you spray with something that'll take out the whitefly, you'll also take out the other things, the ladybirds.
Mm. And it was that thing before we were saying is if there's a lot of aphids, there's going to be hopefully an expansion of the population of things that eat aphids.
And exactly. Then
once they go, the predators go too. So if the best thing to do is try and keep everything in balance.
Advvertisement for diversity of planting, isn't it? Yep. So, and that's what we certainly try and do because we're very keen about bees, not just honeybees, although them, but native bees. We've got great populations of native bees at our place, and so we like to make sure that our large garden is a haven for them, and that's often about having continuity of flowering and successions of flowerings, so there's always food for them there. And it's one of our great pleasures to sit on the front veranda. We've got big pots that contain agastache at the moment, you know, with lovely trumpet flowers full of pollen and nectar, and the native bees are just going dotty at the moment. They can't work hard enough.
That feeds on to birds, the bird population, so keeping those things in balance is always the best way to do that thing. It's obviously not always, especially if you're in a built up area and everyone else has got their one species of grass growing in their property. It's a bit hard to fight the diversity thing, but it's nice to aim for, and that's the best. That's how things have evolved.
In a courtyard just with pots, you know, large pots, and put three different plants in that flower at different times, and you know, three or four pots, and you've basically got it. Yep. So it's fun to do and just to see what does come.
But it's important. Diversity is very important.
Yes.
In all aspects as well. So because I've just done a lot of reading on diversity with the microbial biome. And when you actually have a big, diverse sort of range of microbes, they go into this sort of frenzy, which is called quantum sensing. So they actually, if you've got things like Phytophthora or something in amongst that sort of bacteria, they all have a role. So in quantum sensing is they start gathering information at an atom level and sharing that information. So instead of being what we call a bad microbe, they're actually working together as one, and they're all synergistic
to each other. Yeah.
So they actually come a lot more favourable for the plant. So diversity is actually quite important.
Well, and it goes back to the macro scale. Is we often look at parasites as being these horrible things in our gardens
that we should battle against.
But often the reason we're battling them is because nothing's in balance, so they're able to take over. And if you think of them in an ecological sense, you know, parasites and those type of organisms in ecosystems are really important for whether it be population control. And if you look at, you know, through evolution and things like that, those things are really important.
But there's no such thing.
And they're kept in check when there's that diversity.
Because there's no such thing as a bad bacteria.
No.
Like you're saying, or bad insect, because they're all got
a role.
They've all got a role. And it's that balance. It's if you've got this balance, then they all tend to sort of work together.
Well,
and
this thing about mosquitoes, we've got to get rid of all the mosquitoes in the world so we get rid of malaria. But mosquitoes are very important.
But that's our problem, is because we want to kill everything. And why do we need to kill everything? We don't need to kill everything. Well, we should be actually having that balance where if we have that diverse.
For balance. We do, I think, want to try and cut back on malaria, but yes, we've had a text from Sue Stevens, who used to come into the show regularly, and she says, ladybirds are attracted to mint, so grow mint scattered through your garden. That's how I got them back in mine. And you can make ladybird houses, upside down 2-litre bottle and roll up cardboard that has got ridges and put inside the bottle and hang that in a sheltered spot. It'll bring all sorts of things into the garden. Oh, and they also like flat-topped flowers and things with a strong smell, even lemon balm.
Well, there you are.
So Sue has been observing
her ladybirds.
Her ladybirds, which is absolutely excellent.
Well done, Sue.
Yes, well, I'm just waiting for, you know, not just ladybirds, but all those things that will come and eat what's attacking my veggies.
Well, I think what we've just been discussing about making sure you've got diversity, even within a small space. And I think back to Patsy's vegetable garden where, you know, each vegetable maybe had
a 30 centimetre wide patch, you know, by about 90 centimetres deep, and that was its allocated space. And within each bed there might have been 10, 20 different vegetables things, at different stages. And that is a self-sustaining vegetable garden with regard to the balance of insects, the balance of microbes, the, you know, the turning through the soil, the balancing up.
It's interesting you say that, because I actually was doing I was reading a paper on a lady that was doing a lot of her studies. It was to do with the fungi in the garden, especially in vegetable gardens. And you know how we talk about doing crop rotations,
yes,
where you should be planting your tomatoes in different beds each season. Well, she's saying you don't, because what we're trying to do is we want to try and create that biome with the bacteria and the fungus, which it'll attach itself to that family. So because tomatoes are in that Solanaceae family, but if you have that bacteria and that fungus that attaches itself, then eventually it won't create problems. So they tend to sort of, going back to where I was saying with the diversity, having that diverse in the biome, you go into that quantum sensing. So these problems don't occur. So we think it's bad pathogens that's causing certain, like your blossom end rots and all those sort of things. Well, it's actually, if you have that diverse, then you don't have that problem whatsoever. So it's quite interesting. But then
Penny Woodward was saying that they'd been having this discussion in the garlic community, and that somebody wasn't moving their stuff. Wasn't rotating. And they lasted about 5 years completely successfully and then crashed.
Yeah, so I think if you keep feeding the biome, you shouldn't have
the crash.
The crash.
Well, and keeping up the diversity of not just the biome but also the plants. Like if you've got an acre of one variety of garlic and you grow them there for 5 years, you're going to probably have problems.
Well, it's because you've got
other things planted in that area and you're looking after the biome like you're talking about.
Well, you've got to have that food source too. So when you pull that plant out, so what you've done is you've actually, if you left that plant to sort of die back into the ground, well, it's going to circulate that nutrient. So and the microbes will break it down and same with the fungi, and they'll break it down and utilise the nutrient that's come from the plant. So it has this big circular sort of action with the biome and the plant. So when we're pulling that plant out, we're putting that nutrient back in. So this is where I like to use things like fulvic acid and humic acid, which is a good food source for our bacteria and fungus, which will help to solubilize a lot of nutrient in that soil anyway. Or if you have the ability, instead of pulling everything out, you maybe probably just cut half the plant down if it's not a root vegetable, and then try and sort of do that sort of cut and drop and let that sort of nutrient sort of recirculate. When we're using, I think, root vegetables, then we need to put some sort of organic amendment back in, but you don't want to dig it through. You want to sort of just lay it on top because you don't want to disturb that biome. And it's the mulches we use too. So because we actually use things like so we put layers like Lucerne down, and then on top of that Lucerne we'll put like a wood mulch. Yes. So because there's that balance between the carbon and nitrogen.
Yeah.
So which is that sort of that food source for carbon and nitrogen sort of bacteria.
That'll make worms happy too.
Well, exactly, yeah.
So, and it's just replicating nature.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. That's what we're doing. Yeah. Yes. So, and then, you know, because we're doing that, then eventually we shouldn't have any problems whatsoever. So because the microbes are solubilizing or pulling the atmospheric nitrogen out of our atmosphere and solubilizing potassium and phosphorus in our soils and even also our micronutrients as well, and sort of feeding to the plant. So
our wonderful, wonderful listeners, we've got one from John Cochrane to say the Melbourne Clivia Group is having its first meeting of the year on February the 21st at the Burwood Uniting Church. So that's the Melbourne Clivia Group at the Melbourne Uniting Church on February the 21st. Because we are the 3CR Garden Programme, and our SMS line is 0488 809 855 and our talkback is 9419 0155. Does anybody know a tree called something like Greven occidentalis? One of our listeners has got a mystery tree and she thinks that might be the name.
No, it doesn't ring a bell.
Doesn't ring a bell with me.
I think we're going to have to try a bit harder on that one, Violetta. We'll see where we can go with that. And Peter and Vicky from Notting Hill, so they saw two variegated chestnut trees even though the National Trust says there's only one and it's in Macedon. I wonder where they saw the two different ones. They don't say.
Interesting.
Yes, I do. I used to not like variegation at all, but I've become quite fond of it. Last time Stephen was in here, he had a variegated elder.
Yes.
And it was beautiful.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful. A lot of variegated plants can look really nice, but there's some that can look quite bland as well. It just doesn't, variegation just doesn't suit it.
Mm. It depends what the variegation is. Yeah. I particularly like edges.
Yeah.
You know, paler edges or darker edges, because when the light shines through, it gives real contrast and texture to the plant. Or central striping, I really like.
Which is nice too, yeah.
Because again, it highlights the shape of the leaf. I struggle with splotches.
See, I don't mind splotches. One good example of a good splotch is Berberis Roseglow, the little Berberis Thunbergii hybrid, which is a pink and white variegated on a red, burgundy red leaf.
And the splotches are not too big.
No.
So it kind of sparkles. So I was going to say
the smaller splotches and. Even like that, there was a beautiful maple tree in the garden I grew up in, and it's I'm actually not sure what species it was. It's a very rare one, and it had I would call it variegation, but it was like someone got white spray paint and went like that, like really fast across the leaf.
Yep.
And it was tiny little pinpricks of white all over the leaf on a darker olive background. And I always kind of like that variegation as well, even though it was very subtle. And
well, I completely contradict myself now, because I adore pulmonarias, which have a dark green, dark green background, and then silver splotches or dustings or spots. But somehow it's the texture of the leaf that allows you to get away with it. It doesn't look like a splodge. It's more like a dusting.
Yeah.
Pulmonarias are beautiful foliage plants. Ours, remarkably enough, considering the heat, are doing very, very well at the moment. I'm surprised by them, because
ours have gone funny. Ours have gone pinwheel in the ground now.
They've retreated from the heat.
Yeah, so you've done well.
Peter has come back and said that Violetta saw this tree in Montrose in a community garden. And he's come back and said Violetta's tree is Gruia, Grewia, occidentalis.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we are.
So there we are, Violetta. We didn't know, but one of our listeners did.
Good detective work.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Pete. That's fabulous. So we have that question answered. So, yes, and the Uniting Church for the Melbourne Clivia Group is at 347 Blackburn Road in Burwood. So that's lots of interesting bits and pieces
for us all to do.
And I'm writing these down so that I can put it all on our socials.
Yes, great idea.
Yes. It makes a difference, because there's so much happening. It's easily as busy as spring, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
And then we've got that nice rest period over winter and then we start
work
again.
Work time and then into it again.
Back into it for spring.
But our work time, I mean, ours winter is a work time.
Yes, it is.
In a way it never was when I lived in Britain.
No, that winter there is for sitting by the fire and doing your plant lists. But in Australia it's work time.
You don't have to dig through frost here.
No.
And also, when the soil is really, really wet, you damage it if you keep digging it.
Oh, for sure,
So,
you're best not to keep digging it.
No. At all. Mm. Yes, well, no, that's true. Yeah.
Don't dig it. Yeah. Just keep mulching and feeding.
Keep mulching. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yes, it's very interesting.
Because I think digging can be worse than, nearly just as worse as spraying Roundup.
Yeah.
A chemical in it, because you're damaging so much eco. You're damaging a big ecosystem.
You're killing stuff that is meant to live down there and is suddenly at the top.
Yep.
You know, when I was a young gardener, it was all about double digging, You had to dig a trench and then you had to dig it all over again. And I shuddered to think what we did in those days. But anyway, there we are. We all lived and learned.
Yeah, it's all changed. There's a lot more
research
now. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think that when we plant things, I used to always use a spade, but now I always use the fork, because I've got frogs in my beds.
Yes. Not to mention
the worms.
Worms. Well, we have those big Gippsland worms, not the ginormous carmites, not the huge, huge ones, but I reckon they're six times bigger than a normal worm, great big white fellows and very slow moving. So you have to be terribly careful not to chop them in half because they're precious. They're not, they're quite rare.
Yes, and you don't want to. I don't want to damage any of them.
No,
so I don't even feed to the birds. So I just I'll quickly bury them again. So they keep them in the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's all right. The birds having a worm or three.
Yeah.
Yes, it's. I've just cleaned out my pond, and put the water back in. What, 10 days ago, and there must be 500,000. Tadpoles in there. It's absolutely
frogs have
wonderful.
Found it.
Yeah, so quickly. So.
We wanted to work on some of the ponds up at Forest Glade. Often we'll clean them out, especially in summer. If it's a still water pond, the leaf litter from the previous autumn can start getting a little bit rancid. And I went to look at one of the ponds and it's just full of tadpoles, ginormous big tadpoles. And it's like, oh, we can't do that. Like, we'll just have to wait till next year. It doesn't smell that bad.
Missed the chance. And you know what?
And for good reason too.
Do you know what tadpoles eat? I had a little girl up, and she wanted to get in the pond, so she got in the pond, and she was absolutely fascinated by all the tadpoles. She wanted to know what they eat, and I said, well, they eat algae and they eat leaf matter that's in the pond. And she said, is there anything I can feed them? So I looked it up. They eat boiled lettuce.
Well, there you go.
But they don't like boiled cabbage.
There you go.
Yeah.
Who would have thunk it?
Share their opinion too, yeah.
So if you've got tadpoles and they haven't got enough food, boil them some lettuce.
And if you've got a pond too, there's lots of choice. You know, the go-to for most people's ponds are goldfish. And those sorts of things, but there's some, I think, native fish and other species that you can use that will eat, say, mosquito larvae, but they won't eat tadpoles. I think it's a cloudfish or something they're called.
The pygmy perch is an Australian one that it'll eat the tiniest tadpoles, but very quickly the tadpoles grow out of their feeding
but
range.
They've got a big enough mouth to cope with most wrigglers and mosquito larvae and things like that. So, looking at adding something like that to the water instead of just going for the goldfish, which will eat the tadpoles.
I think goldfish is a terrible idea. And then also, if for some reason they escape into the waterways. And
they're not small goldfish anymore.
No, they become carp.
Huge carp. Place, probably, yeah.
Yes, and... I think that's actually really important. It's actually quite hard. I've found somewhere where you can get pygmy perch, so I'll tell you about that after the show. It is actually quite hard to find places to get what we need, which is small native fish. I mean, it's much more sensible to be trying to use native fish.
Yeah, yeah.
And goldfish. Oh,
escape never. Goldfish is a terrible environmental
problem.
Disaster.
And people say, oh, well, they'll never escape from my place. But,
somehow they do.
Exactly. Well, one, a flood. Two, somebody pinching one and then getting sick of it and throwing it away.
Down the toilet.
Yeah, they do get away. Di, one of our producers, has said that milkweed gets lots of aphids. And if you let them go, then the ladybirds will come to that, which will help your crops generally. And, of course, that is the other thing about nature. I mean, being too keen to get rid of all the so-called weeds, sometimes that's not a good idea as well.
Weeds are good.
Yeah,
because they actually start to fix the soil. That's exactly what
they
do.
That's what their job is.
So once the soil gets to a certain stage, that particular weed eventually just dies out. You'll get probably get another weed, but it's actually to that next level.
Mm.
So it's like a...
They're all pioneer plants, weeds, so generally, aren't they?
Generation, to fix that soil, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Their job is, if somewhere gets majorly disturbed, they're the first ones in there to turn it back into a working ecosystem.
Well, so the capeweed.
Cut and drop. That's what you've got to do. Just cut it. If you find before it flowers, you cut it and you drop it.
And leave it there.
That's fixing the soil.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's what we're going to do.
Into mulch.
And that's what we do. Because we've got allopathic soils on the back of our property and hydrophobic soils as well. And that's all I've done. Like all the grass clippings and all my weeds just goes up into that area and it's fixed. Mm. So now I'm growing things like Lobelia tupa in there and things like that. Yeah, and it's all growing quite successfully.
Well, and capeweed's the classic. Mm. You know, you get through a drought, you get a damaged area, and the next year, what is there? The capeweed.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
And it looks fabulous and is absolutely terrible.
Yes. Actually, if it's time for us to talk about some of our plants, I brought one along that
please do.
Might be the right time to talk about following the conversation we've been having. And it's a beautiful plant that I know Ben loves in his garden and we certainly love in ours in its various forms, Baptisia australis. Now, don't let the australis bit fool you. It's not an Australian native. Australis just means of the south. And Baptisia is a plant that, although not native to Australia, is absolutely perfectly made for Australian gardens. It grows as a member of the pea family. So we've been talking about fixing nitrogen and making permanent plantings that help the biome in the soil. And Baptisia is one of those plants. It's a member of the pea family, so it's nitrogen fixing. But it also grows with an extremely deep taproot, which means that it's resistant to periods of dry. In its native habitat, it's used to long, hot, dry periods over summer.
Where does it come from?
It's native to areas in the United States where it's a very extreme climate, so it's well adapted to us. It's a handsome plant. The original form, which is Baptisia australis, can grow up to about 90 centimetres tall if it's in a good posy. It's doing really well, a bit shorter if it's, you know, going in tougher ground. But ground is not a problem to it. It grows in anything from sand to clay. And a plant that will grow in either a sandy soil or a clay soil is a very handy plant for Australian gardeners, I think. So it does pretty well in poor soil. If it's given a good garden loam, it'll be absolutely spectacular with an arching shape, beautiful sort of sea blue-grey foliage, round leaves, handsomely clothed with leaves, but it's the flowers that are sensational because all of the flowers I chose to bring along today are my favourite blues. I love blue in the garden and I love summer blue in the garden because it's so cooling. So our Baptisia flowering with bright, vivid, perfect blue pea flowers in late spring, early summer is a beast to behold.
It is absolutely beautiful. I remember the first time I ever saw it, which was in Beth Chatto's garden.
Yes.
And I was just gobsmacked.
Yeah, because it's so beautiful. Pure a blue. Mm. There's another form that's perhaps more suitable for smaller gardens that we offer seed for, and it's Baptisia australis variety minor meaning smaller. And this one only grows 30 to 60 centimetres tall. And lo and behold, the smaller plant actually has the bigger flowers, which makes it really showy for a small garden. It's not quite as intense a blue. It's sort of more a violet blue. But lo and behold, rabbits don't like it. I love anything that my rabbits don't like. Even deer will pass it by in preference for something else. I mean, no plant in the midst of a drought when the rabbits are really hungry, as you were describing, they're doing all sorts of unusual things this year because there's too many of them and they're starting to get hungry in this dry summer. Not enough feed around for them. They'll attack almost anything. But let's just say they're the last things that rabbits and deer will attack.
Well, that's very important.
Yes, absolutely. And very frost hardy because of its native habitat. It's used to really low winter temperatures. It can stand down to at least minus 20 degrees Celsius. So,
well, it's usually in the ground.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. If it gets too frosty, it will die right back over the winter and then reshoot again beautifully.
Well, Beth Chatto's garden is absolutely certain to get cold.
Yes.
Because it's
dry cold too.
It's on the east of
yep.
Britain, so and gets those Siberian winds.
And very sandy, draining soil. Mm. So, yes, it's a good hardy survivor.
And pollinators love it, which is another important aspect for me to choose a garden plant.
Yes.
Beautiful, gorgeous colour, tough. Pollinators love it, and rabbits don't like it.
I think it's one of the most beautiful of the blue flowers. I think it is absolutely gorgeous.
It's so blue, isn't it? Mm. And I think the foliage colour really sets off that blue, that sort of sea blue grey matte foliage is handsome even when the plant is not in flower.
Absolutely. I think it's a wonderful plant. And I've got a blue lupin that comes out earlier, which is also extremely blue and has got a similarly greyish flower. And it's the two of them together
look really sensational, yeah. And the other thing that we plant in the same area, because all of these things like the full sun and are quite dry hardy, is cerinthy, the honeybell or honeywort it's sometimes called. And again, it's that fabulous combination of blue bells nodding, almost like an English bluebell shape to the flower. They're sort of crooked over top with nodding bells of blue. But it's a combination of the purple blue of the flower against really sea blue, grey, green foliage and quite lustrous foliage. So again, a great combination for
beautiful little plant, yeah,
and that's only the Baptisia is a perennial, a very long lived perennial. You'll have it for decades once you've got your clump established. And Ben was talking earlier before we were on air that sometimes they take a little while to establish, and that often happens with plants that go for years and years, decades. Mm. They take a year or two to get their roots. They're often very deep rooted,
usually about after about 2 to 3 years, and then after that then you're just basically reap the benefits
for the rest of your life.
They're fantastic when they're flowering.
There's
something that you won't just walk past it, you will have a second glance at it and then stop.
It does stop you in your tracks.
It does,
because of the electric blueness
quite
of
pretty,
it.
Yeah, and there's also like, because have you got the white seed yet?
No, I have not been able to get any white seeds. So if there's any gardeners out there who have a white Baptisia, used to have one, lost it, so haven't got any seed at the moment.
I've got the seed down, the white.
Yep.
So if I get the seed, I'll give you one.
Okay, we'll swap.
That way you've got the pure white.
Oh, I love it. Used to have it, adored it.
Yeah.
And the opposite for that is the cerinthy, which is an annual.
Yes.
And once they get established, that basically means that there's a little bit of a seed bank of them have them, and they just pop up.
They do pop up.
In between other things, yeah.
Constant. I love it. I have it planted amongst old rugosa roses, and it just pops up basically all through the year. So they have a very hard black seed. They're easy to spot. So you can
harvest little peas with a ridge sort of on one side. Flat spot.
That's it. And you can pop the seed around where you want them to come, but you only have to do it once because they're just self perpetuating all the time.
And they're in the borage family, I think, aren't they?
They are in the borage family. Yeah. What Ben was talking about, they're actually very good for the soil nutrition as well. And being self-perpetuating is a handy thing, but easy to weed out if they perpetuate themselves in a spot you don't happen to want them.
Yeah.
But they're light too. They're not heavily foliaged and they're quite slender. So they are good companion plants to put amongst other things to give that beautiful foliage colour and rich blue.
So if you want to look that up, that's cerinthy,
C-E-R-I-N-T-H-E. The normal one is cerinthy major purpurescens, which has a sort of purple flush to the blue bells. But we also have one called kiwi blue. I'm beginning to suspect it was possibly developed in New Zealand. But it's even bluer. The flower is even bluer. And if anything, the foliage is even bluer. This lovely satin sheen to the leaves. So,
and you can get a yellow one, but I think the blue is the more stunning.
Yeah. The yellow one, and also bees love blue. Blue is a colour that bees are highly attracted to. So they're good pollinator.
The Borage plants. Family have found out in echiums and all sorts of things, all those Borage family members that have got the bright blue flowers and are really good bee attractors.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I love the yellow one, and it's very, very heavy in nectar, so it's a good bee food plant. But the blue one, they love the flowers because of the colour. They can see it.
They have the yellow one at Fernie Creek.
Yes.
It won't be out at the moment, I don't imagine, but that's somewhere where one can go and see a cerinthy flower and an unusual one.
Well, and very dry hardy too. Again, it copes with heat and dry really well.
Well, I got some seeds off you a couple of months ago and put them up at Forest Glade, and they've now got them hopefully established in a few spots around the garden for that very reason, because it's really, especially when you've got 15 acres, it's really good to have a plant that you know is going to come up once it's in that spot.
It's always
you can weed and do whatever you need to do, and that'll come up. And if you see it, you leave it. If it's in the way, you pull it out. And but you know that there's a bit of a seed bank in there.
Well, and that's, if there's a vacant that's the spot, same with this up. Blue lupin as well. Mm. And it's not the Russell lupin, so it's much hardier. I mean, you have it, Ben.
Yeah,
I have it. I think I started them all, and I got it originally from Lorraine, who's one of the Fernie Creek people. She'll have things for sale at Fernie Creek, and it's just fantastic because it's an annual, but it comes up totally reliably, so you don't have to.
It just self-seeds.
It just self-seeds, and it doesn't spread.
No,
it spreads, you know, around itself, as it were.
Yes, yes.
And interestingly, Violetta's come back, and she wants to know why her Russell lupins aren't flowering. And I have no idea, but the first thing that leaps to mind is that Russell lupins are a weed in New Zealand.
Yeah.
And the reason they're a weed in New Zealand is because they've got rain. And so if your Russell lupins are struggling, I would suspect the heat wouldn't help.
They have a different sort of chemical requirement to a lot of plants. They do love superphosphate. Lupins, really? They're heavy feeders on superphosphate, Often if they're not flowering, that's it. The chemical balance is not quite right for them. Give them a little bit of super, just dusting around them.
Or any feed would probably help, wouldn't it?
Yeah, a good balanced feed would certainly help.
So what's a good natural form of phosphates then? Is it blood and bones not too bad for if you didn't want to put down?
You probably don't want to give them too much nitrogen. The blood and bone would be
so
heavy.
So is there a good
nitrogen
phosphate source that's natural? So because I know a lot of people don't like putting super on their garden.
No, that's right.
And in small doses it can be quite useful. But
it's not the sort of – I would suspect that Violetta won't have any in her
– No.
So we get ours flowering all the time.
Your Russell lupins.
Yeah, so – and we've got all the colours. So and
likewise.
Yeah, so the red is probably the most stunning. It's just we tend to put a lot of fulvic and humic around it. And and I think it's because it's sort of making the bacteria really active.
That's the answer to pretty much everything, isn't it?
It really is because
organic matter in there.
Because they solubilise, because you'd be surprised how much phosphorus and potassium is actually in our soils.
Yeah.
It's just, you know,
if the balance the availability is right.
sort of quantities. And then if you've got that sort of balance where they're solubilising that nutrient, it's only in small amounts, but it's constantly, frequently, all the time.
Yeah.
So the plant's utilising 100% of it. Where if you start using superphosphate, then you apply it, 80% to 90% of that, you actually it either burns off or it leaches through the soil. So you're actually losing it.
Yeah.
So to capture that, you need to have that microbial sort of biome.
I'd be nearly inclined to give them a foliar watering with some seaweed or fish product, which will give them the nutrients that they're obviously lacking, but without applying it to, of course it goes into the soil, but they can take it in quickly.
It's more useful too for the actual individual plant.
They can take it
in
quickly through their leaves and that will help.
But when you do that, you want to do that first thing in the morning. So within 20 minutes, 80% of that nutrient will be absorbed into the plant. So if it's done first thing in the morning, and usually underneath the leaf.
Yep.
Yeah. Trace elements is probably really good for that too, because for any a lot of those sort of major nutrients, so it all needs to get into an amino acid. It needs its micronutrients as well to sort of help that burn into the next stage to an amino acid.
But we also have to think about what Violet has probably got in her barn or her shed. And
so the sea salts are really good. Yeah. We've had troubles with the hydrangeas at Forest Glade. We've got this huge hydrangea hill, and it was fed with chemical fertilisers for many years, which I don't think, because Heidi's don't like phosphates that much.
Exactly.
And anyway, it had been fed poorly for many years and pruned not very well. And they've just struggled for the last 5 years. And I thought I might as well treat them like I treat the potted hydrangeas, where I spray them with sea salt and maybe give them a feed with iron shellate at once or twice a season.
Sure.
And all these other things with the spray, like using the sprays. So I've sprayed all the garden hydrangeas this year, and the colours are amazing. The leaf growth is much better
because they've been able to take up that nutrient.
And it's you're using far less of the actual fertilisers and whatnot, and it's doing far more work than it would if you're throwing pellets and all sorts of stuff down on the ground. And by the time it does get into the soil, it's been filtered through that system. And then it's a little bit more accessible anyway. So as you say, it's adding to the biome rather than
fulvic acid and humic acid.
Yeah.
So switch it up.
So where can you get those?
So you've got to jump online and order it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of companies out there that actually do fulvic and humic acid.
Yeah.
I've got a company I pull out of Queensland called NTS, which is Nutritech Solutions.
Yeah.
Mm. Graham said he's an agronomist. He's amazing. His knowledge is amazing, but he actually makes these products, and the products that he makes are fantastic. So, but look, there's local companies here in Victoria that.
It is a really good way to get stuff into plants without overdoing it and throwing stuff down in the soil, especially
and
the
it helps to harden up the cell walls in the plant structure, which gives them more resistance to heat and. You know, hot winds, etc. Yep. So,
yeah. It helps to capture that moisture as well.
Hold it in.
Just sea salt. Yeah. Just even if that's all you've got.
That's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. Nothing wrong with sea salt or Maxicop.
I think it is. Because I used to always water sea salt in, but I think spraying much better use of sea salt than watering stuff in.
And it's great when you've got plants under big trees where you've got an enormous amount of root competition. That's the way to feed the plants. Then the plants are getting it and the trees are not stealing it off.
Well, they're getting it secondhand once it's in the system.
Yeah, well, that's fine. The trees can have what's left over, but spray the plants with the foliar feed.
Yeah, it helps enormously. Really, really efficient way of doing it, and the plants love it, yeah.
Now I have another question for us from Lynn in Paran, and she wants to know how does she cut back her passion fruit after it's been fruiting?
Oh, I think you slash away, basically.
I don't think there's a particular way at all. I think you've got to make sure you've got to do it at the right time of year.
Well, after fruiting. Yeah. Yeah. Because it fruits on current year's growth. So
you've got to do it straight away.
Yeah. I remember watching something and I think they do it early. I think they do it early because if you do it too late, then when it puts that growth on, I don't think it's enough for it to flower the following season, or it can become too late to prune it.
You've got to get straight into it.
Yeah, they're fruiting now, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah.
I've got green ones on my vine.
Yeah, so for time when they ripen, is it going to be too late to actually do that sort of that prune for it to enough to produce that new growth for that following season's flowering?
Well, a good way to try it.
I think it's early. I'm pretty sure it's early.
But what do you mean by early, Ben?
Like
you
spring.
But then you're going to cut off the fruit.
Fruit.
The flowers. I think it's – no, I think you cut it early. I'm pretty sure they cut early.
I think we'll have to
take your higher authority on it.
Yes.
But a good way of dealing with that problem, working it out, what works for your area, because it depends on your climate and your garden situation and, you know, all sorts of factors, is to do half and see how it works and not do the other half and then
if you hard prune immediately after fruiting, you know, fruits well next year, you've got it for your area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But also, it's always a good way to experiment.
Yeah. Also, next week we've got Jack Semler, Stephen Ryan and Tim Sampson, so we'll put this question to them again. As well.
Yeah, good thinking.
Have a listen next week, Lynn, and we might have a more definitive answer for you. And also have a look online.
But I always think the rule of thumb, not the law, but the rule of thumb is for once flowering things, cut them immediately after flowering or fruiting in this case. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for your once flowering rose, for example.
Exactly. You have to do it immediately. After flowering because they need to ripen the wood to get the next, pump out the next season's crop.
Mm. Yes. And they tend to be, those once flowering roses tend to be the very big ones.
Yes. And mass flowers. Because they do it all at once instead of staggering it over a longer period. It's a fabulous show.
So what other blue have you got there?
Oh, I just adore blue in the garden, summer blue. The one of the other ones that I brought is a rare little species penstemon, which I absolutely adore because it's the bluest of blue. It's not a big plant, very suitable for small gardens or indeed pots, and handsome foliage as well. So the stems of flowers, the spires of flowers, probably about 30 to 45 centimetres when they're on full tippy toes. And instead of having those big blousy trumpets that a lot of modern bred penstemons have, it has more separated whorls of flowers. So up the stem you get sort of stepladder layers of flowers enclosing the stem. That's another thing with some species penstemons. They only flower on one side of the stem, but this little guy, Penstemon mensarum, or otherwise known as the Grand Mesa penstemon, flowers all the way around the stem. So quite refined trumpets, open lips so the bees and the honey eaters can get down into those trumpets. A number of spires per plant, but rising up from a low clump of foliage. It's an evergreen plant, but it does respond to the cold of autumn and early winter by the foliage going quite lovely plum colours. So it's a great winter foliage plant in its low clump. And then sort of from mid-spring onwards, it starts to throw up these beautiful spires.
And I find the rabbits don't tend to go for the penstemons.
No, they don't touch our penstemons. I mean, not that our rabbits are tremendously hungry. They've got such a lot to choose from in the garden and our paddocks really go bare or dry off completely. So rabbits are pretty well fed in our area. But no, they've never touched a penstemon in our garden. But this little Grand Mesa penstemon is native to Colorado. So that gives you an idea of the huge diversity of dramatic climate change that it can cope with. It can cope with heat and dry in the summer and lots of frost in the winter, as long as the soil is well drained. That's the only thing that will see it off is really heavy clay, unlike our baptisias, which, well, they don't seem to mind where they grow. Any soil will do for them. But this little penstemon, well worth finding. It's relatively easy to germinate from seed and a long-lived perennial, so you're going to have those blue summer spires. And it's intense blue. It's pure blue. Very dainty plant.
I've got a rather sad message here. Roz from Merrick's. I can't get rid of the horseradish.
Oh, no, you're right. Yes. Constant battle. Boy, is it a persistent root.
Oh, it's a shocker. She's got it in a vegetable garden and just can't get rid of it. I think I have. It's taken me about 5 years to get rid of it.
Yep.
And I've had to dig deep, even though digging's bad for your garden. I've had to dig deep to get it out.
To get this fellow out. Yeah, they're really very persistent deep. Roots. And you can't eat enough horseradish to make use of it.
And it's incredibly, as a crop, it's incredibly valuable. People pay a fortune for horseradish.
Oh, maybe you should dig it up and take it down to the local fruit shop.
Ever is it going in my garden again.
No, I think it's for a big tub
on a concrete slab so it can't get out.
Yeah. Absolutely, Meryl.
It ranks right up there with mint.
Oh, it is. Well, no, it's worse than mint.
Because I think
mint,
it might be.
Mint will die in the drought.
Yeah.
I mean, it will come back. But horseradish, nothing stops it.
No, nothing stops it.
Have either of you?
No, I never tried it.
Oh.
I've got it, but in a pot.
Yeah, I think a pot is the go.
It's a safe spot, yeah, because I know exactly what it's going to do. So.
Yes, a pot on concrete. Yes.
On concrete, yeah.
It's extraordinary, an extraordinary plant. So I'm really
We feel sorry, your pain.
Roz from Merrick's, we do feel your pain and we think that, you know, dig.
Yeah.
That's what you got to do.
Unfortunately.
It's
hard work.
Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know if poisons work because I don't use them, but I mean, I do use them on blackberries. I have to. I have got paddocks. Mm. But I didn't try poisons because...
No, haven't tried it on ours either.
But if it got into my paddocks...
Oh, it'd be a nightmare.
Absolute.
Mm.
I can't imagine who's cropping it. Somebody must be.
Somebody must be in very big pots.
Maybe that's why it's so expensive. Because nobody will crop it. Mm. There's not a farmer in Australia that's prepared to do it.
What'll I do?
Yeah, it's difficult. Mm. And that's something to think about, though. What is flowering now?
Gosh, so much.
I've brought in a plant that's flowering. It's in the Campanulaceae family. It's called Azurina vidalii.
Beautiful thing.
It is. It comes from the Azores. Yeah. So it is a coastal plant, a rocky sort of coastal plant. But where we have it planted, we've got it in morning sun, afternoon shade, and it absolutely loves it where it is. So all we do is we make sure it's in a spot where there's no water lying over winter. It doesn't like wet feet over winter. And also, like with the hot, dry summers, it will handle the hot, dry summers as well. So we don't need to sort of splash water around too much around it because it's probably classed as like a semi-succulent sort of type of plant because it actually has this nice little long lineal sort of type of leaf that's very sort of thick and waxy. And it's sort of only a small growing bush, probably about the maximum, probably about, say, 60 centimetres in height.
Yeah.
It
just makes a nice clump, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. So, but the flowers... It's
a very pretty flower.
The flowers will actually, the spikes will come on the previous season's growth. So you'll often have this big clump of sort of foliage and branching inside the plant, and then when it flowers, it sends the flowers on the outside sort of out and up. And so it reaches around about sort of 60 centimetres high. With a flower spike, it's probably about, with the flowers on, 20, 30 centimetres. So it's not a big flower spike, but you get a big cluster of these waxy, beautiful pink bell-shaped flowers. Very similar to like the campanulas, but you can see that the flowers are much thicker.
So yeah, more waxy, yeah, substantial.
And shiny as well. So
how do you spell it, Ben,
so
people?
It's Azorina, and that's vidalii.
Yeah.
So the common name is the Azores bellflower. So Stephen Ryan was telling me he was in the Azores and he said he was actually just walking through fields of it.
Oh, how amazing.
He said it was quite spectacular.
He's doing that tour again, not this year, but next year.
Yeah, so this I'll have available in spring, this one. And you do get, there's two colours. There is this pink and there's also a pure white. Now, it is what they call monotypic, so it's the only one that's in its species, in its genus. So to get the white, it has to be done through seed, and it's just randomly done through seed. So, if I actually have the white, I couldn't guarantee that I can get the white.
Yeah.
It'll either, you know, you do the seed and
you just have to buy some a heap of them.
You do, that's,
some
that's
will be
it.
Pink.
Yeah, and it's, the thing is it's easy to probably get from seed.
It is easy from seed, and it sets a lot of seed.
It does, but it's the actual transplanting at a young age. That's the tricky part.
Yeah.
You can do 1,000 seeds, and then you'll be lucky to get maybe 2 out of it.
And actually, it's the same if you're growing the baptisia from seed, and there's many other plants that fit into this category. You've got to germinate the seed and prick them out really quickly because the Baptisia is so tough because it makes that big taproot, and it makes that, it starts making that big taproot really quickly, and it doesn't like being disturbed once it's getting that taproot down. So you've got to prick them out of the seedling tray.
That's probably a general thing for a lot of dry climate plants, isn't it? The reason they're good in dry climates is because they need to establish their root system
quickly and down
deep.
You don't
want to be messing with it.
But it's funny because if I get this into a 6-inch size pot, then the transportation of that, or sort of replanting it from there, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's just when they're really little.
Yeah, correct.
Where we struggle. But look, it's a stunning plant.
It is.
People who went to our Open Garden for Creative Harvest, a lot of people would have seen it then, but the Open Garden that we did have in November, they weren't even budding then. So,
but also in November, October, November, we've got a lot of stuff in flower. Find things like the Azarina that are actually in flower now, because we have got less in flower. I mean, there's a lot in flower in my garden, but it is less than in high spring.
Well, it is. And the other one I have is the Brilliantasia. So that's the other one that's actually just the opposite side in our garden bed. And we've got a colony of probably about, I think, 6 or something in there. So, and I want to sort of expand that colony of them. They're fantastic.
I find the Brilliantasia that I have in the garden never really grow big, whereas the ones I have in pots are very happy and just come up and...
They can get quite tall,
Yes, whereas the ones in the garden, they find the... Do you grow Brilliantasia?
No.
It's one of the ones they call a blue sage.
Giant tropical sage. So it comes from the tropical parts of Africa. So
comes from Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe,
Probably why it doesn't like me.
Well, quite, and I think that's why I struggle with it in the garden. Yeah. Stephen and I saw it when we were in on our way to Madeira, and we just saw a whole mass of it growing in around a creek bed.
And he went, ah!
We were hysterical, and Craig, Stephen's partner, I mean, he just rolled his eyes and looked at the two of us as we tore down this hill to the creek bed.
It is. It's quite stunning. Yeah.
Absolutely fabulous.
Look, it's not that good in winter.
No, it looks terrible in winter.
It gets that sort of hypoxic sort of look about it. Yeah, the leaves are real yellow and white, and you get that burnt look. So we just let it go, and then come mid-spring it sort of starts putting on that nice growth as well. So, because the other thing I have flowering now is the Globularia scania. So I have spoken about this before, but this comes from the Canary Islands, usually around the pine sort of forest areas. So if you struggle growing things around, if you have pine trees, this is an ideal plant.
Mm.
And it is actually a rare and endangered species. So, and that's a lot to do with probably with a lot of sort of development that usually happens around where it's actually from. So it's only a small bush, probably only about a metre high. Good flowering. It's like it's in full bloom now. And then once that sort of flush of flower starts to sort of die off a little bit, I often will give it a prune and it'll flower again in autumn as
just
well.
Just a light tip prune.
Usually prune it back to just underneath the flower spike. So the flower spike, you probably about sort of 20 centimetres.
Yep.
And it's a cluster of these nice, beautiful white sort of globe flowers with a blue centre.
Yes.
So they're quite pretty.
It's Asteraceae, I think, is it? Is it one of the Aster family members?
Yes, it is,
So it's got the composite sort of almost like a daisy type flower, but it's you can't see the little yellow disc in the...
No, you can't. So it's sort of scattered all over when you do sort of have a closer look at it.
And we have a lot of the globularias that are little low ground covering plants or edging plants, but the same rather than bush... But same sort of flowering habit, stems coming up and then a burst of, again, beautiful blue.
And there's different shades of the blues,
flowers.
I'm very interested in something that'll grow underneath a pine tree, though.
Yes, exactly.
It does. It does. It grows really well. It handles it.
And can you say the name slowly for us?
It's called Globularia ascani. So
glob, as in...
Glob?
Yeah, glob. So it's Globularia.
Just so people can look it up if they wish to. But
we will have it for sale at Fernie Creek. All our expos that we do, we often will have small numbers of it. We don't tend to do big numbers of it. So.
And will you have the Azarina at Fernie Creek?
No, that's going to be spring. Right. So I actually lost the seed last year, so I'm sort of kicking myself for that one. So... It's easier to propagate. It doesn't take much for it to come up. So I'm going to trial and experiment with a few different ways of how I'm going to do the seeds and find out what's going to be more successful. So, because I don't know if it's a – I had this discussion with Clive, and we don't know if it's a genetic thing if you know, because it produces so many seeds. Is there a gene that tells a lot of the seeds to not grow?
Because there's so many of
there's
them.
There's so many because of the competition sort of thing. Yeah, so yeah. I'm going to trial different things with it. Yeah.
And are you bearing the flower of a
It's not an Eremurus. They look like Eremurus. I've only bought one thing in today, and it's the Drimia maritima, which is in the related to the skillers, actually in the asparagus family. So Drimia maritima is mainly centred around eastern Mediterranean. I think Greece would be one of the coastal areas in Greece you would see it. A massive bulb, probably one of the biggest actual bulbs I've ever grown. Some of them can get up to, you know, bowling ball size in the ground, sitting fairly close to the surface. Quite nice foliage. It's sort of broad leaves that taper towards the tip with a wavy edge. And then at this time of year, it's one of the few bulbs I have at home that likes to flower at this time of the year, right in the middle of summer. It sends up what look like Eremurus flowers.
Yeah, sure very does. Pale. Or foxtail lilies, folks, to give them their common name.
So they get, they're usually somewhere between 50 and 150 centimetres, a pale whitish sort of colour, and quite showy. It's probably, if you can find someone that sells them, you'll probably be waiting a few years to get a big clump of them, but I was lucky enough to be given some many years ago, and I've got about 20 or 30 of them at home, and 10 or 12 are flowering at the moment. Just a pretty – and so like the harshest conditions.
Absolutely.
Like plant them between two rocks.
That's it. I was about to say.
In the middle of a paddock.
One of the most breathtaking sights of my life is a rocky hillside in Sicily, you know, which would bake. It'd be like the – vent of Mount
Etna.
It's
even
hot
at night because the rocks heat up.
That's right. So hot.
So they never escape.
So dry, and there they are in full flower, loving like it. Acres of them. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So a question to both of you. Do you know who might sell that?
I'd always ask Jane up at
Tonkin's. I think Jane Tonkin.
If you've got any bulb that you want, go and ask Jane.
Jane.
True. About it.
And for your penstemon, do you know anyone who sells it as a plant, or is it only available from you as seed?
I've never seen anyone selling a plant.
That was penstemon
mensarum, the grand Mesa penstemon. And the Mesa part of the name gives the game away as to where it grows. It's in tough conditions.
The Baptisia, you've got the two varieties of seeds.
Seed, yep.
I'm growing the blue. But I'm also, I've sowed the seed of the white.
Fingers crossed, Ben, for both of us.
Yeah. It's doing really good because they're all viable seeds, but I also have a yellow as well. So hopefully I'll have
and
that.
So
that
what,
won't be until spring before I have those.
You won't have the blue one in autumn?
Yeah, no, not in autumn. No, that's going to be for, all of them I'll have for spring.
Spring.
So, including the white. So, but I don't think the white will be very limited because I want to get more of that into the garden.
You've got to get it going so you can safely have it in the future.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes. Mm. This is so, and you will be at the Upper Yarra Valley Plant Fair.
Yes.
For people who want to come and also people can buy the seed from you online.
Correct. Yes. And it's www.seedscape.net.au. We only sell online or the shows.
And at that point, I think we'd better say goodbye because it's nearly time for us to go. Oh. Cheers, everybody.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.